Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about episode 5 of the Iron Monarch, a classic marine story told by an absolute genius and friend, Dennis Bainbridge. He's compiled this book full of enough information to interest any engineering type out there. And we've followed this bespoke ship, which has rushed into history to actually move steel around Australia. Australia being a very big place with rather government-owned railways, they needed to top it down. And the ship has been put together, the turbines have gone out, with avoiding vanadium and salt and other things, and heating their awful carbon-rich cargo, ready to burn it and take it up in a gas turbine. Beautiful thought, so to speak. And we're in the seashells. Sea trials. Now, just to give you an idea, there's the map of Australia, South Australia. There's this little leg coming down from the bottom of South Australia. And the Gulf of Vincent, or St. Vincent maybe, Vincent Gulf is where Adelaide is. Then there's this peninsula, there's another peninsula there. And between that is another called Spencer Gulf in Whyalla. And we've had this thing, there were many interesting spectators attended the sea trials due to the unique concept of the ship. They included the editor of the British magazine Motor Ship and representatives of major equipment suppliers. There was a lot of interest in this new ship as the innovative steel handling system. A sea trial in figure 42 shows the beautiful lines and the ease in which the hull of the ship slips through the water. During full speed, 20 knots run, there wasn't any vibrations even during a full ahead astern test. One had the feeling then that the ship was special and that it was a delight to sail for its crew. One engineer, I think, Kevin Colson, told me it was great not to be carried along by a series of explosions. Well, there you go. Oh, my God, there's pictures of it. There's lots of happy people there. Okay, and now this is the TGV Iron Monarch handover in 73. And I don't know whether I can see Dennis in there. Let's see. No, he's not there. Oh, there's some, you know, there's a couple of people sporting some called lamb chop sideburns. It's a beautiful thing to see. Tweed clothes, lots of books and signing for the Iron Monarch. Thank you very much. After the handover, there was a union dispute over the number of engineers allocated to the vessel. The engineers' union was firm that there should be 4 engineers, which would prevent the chief engineer from performing which wash duties. There was a stalemate for some time while the dispute was being resolved. During this period, Reg Jones manned the diesel alternators to provide the ship's power. Reg had designed the ship as an unmanned engine room and was firm that the ship didn't need 4 engineers. In the end, a decision was made to provide 4 engineers for the trial period. This decision was never reversed. Isn't that amazing? So for all that technology, for all the aspects of it, the unions at the end said, isn't that an amazing thing that we did all this work to automate it, and then unions came in and trashed it. You can imagine why these people are so right-wing. Okay, chapter 8, Into Service. The manager settled, defects and modifications completed, and eventually a few hundred tons of Bass Strait Wexy crude was made available for the initial test voyage. The vessel was ready to depart Whyalla in October the 18th, 1973. The man of the ship was captain of 4 mates, cadet, chief engineer and 3 engineers, electrical engineer, wireless operator, shipwright, chief steward, bosun, deck seaman donkey. Who is this sixth deck seaman? What is a donkey man? Stewart's mess room attendant. Cooks, two cooks, and greasers, three. That was a greaser. Amazing. So let's add this up. That's 10, 13, 14, 20, 25, 31 people. Amazing. You'd never have that number. I think you have these super tankers only have five people in it now. This manning has been greatly reduced over the years as maritime industry modernised, electronics and other technology improved, and in this case, tremendous retraining of waterside personnel was now completed. Shipboard cranes, forklifts, straddle carriers were no longer new concepts to the stevedoring industry. The maiden voyage. Several hours after the arrival of Tony Wakeman, the fourth engineer of the ship, to leave Whyalla for Port Kembla using distillate fuel as waxy residual was available in Whyalla, being used for furnace oil only in small quantities. It was difficult to bunker a ship. On the 17th tank soundings, the ship had 438.8 tons of distillates and 456 tons of waxy fuel. Should be noted that the price of waxy oil has now climbed to $35 a ton. The world was now clearly in the throes of the first oil shock. Oh, isn't that amazing? So they got rid of the oil shock. The company view was to leave port in at sea mode. Let's try and get this. Using shaft alternator. However, the chief engineer wasn't happy about this and wouldn't allow the switch until the ship was clear of port. Just as well he did, for when the approval was given, the switch blacked out as the design of the turbine running on the HP shaft alternator and emergency diesel cut in. Three further attempts were made and the same result, so any further attempts were called off to prevent equipment damage. The trip continued on diesel power to Port Kembla. Oh my god, after all that effort, he didn't use a steam turbine. This must have been a disappointment for Rich Jones, and one of his great concepts failed the first test. The changeover was never reliable due to droop differences between diesel and shaft alternators. The controls had difficulty in synchronising. I believe a change in diesel governors could have assisted in curing this problem. On arrival in Port Kembla, C.E. Collison went on leave, and second engineer Ken Farrell was moved to chief engineer. The ship had to travel to Cairns Cross dock in Brisbane to have its hull launching fittings removed and a general hull clean-up. Well, there you go. After leaving Brisbane, the ship travelled to Newcastle to pick up personnel. The loaded sea trial to be held on November the 1st, 73, off port. Performance readings were taken and calculated, which showed the fuel rate was 3% better than guarantee of 0.44 pounds per shaft HP hour. The propeller, including shaft alternator reduction gear and other losses at 480 degrees Fahrenheit, ambient temperature propeller, HP, whatever it is. After this trial, the ship travelled to Port Kembla to receive the first cargo. On the trip to Melbourne on November the 12th, 1973, off Gabo Island, performed a 360-degree turn trial. Captain Peter Lamarck paid off 5th on the 12th, 73, to Captain Bill Lloyd, joined the ship. Operating problems. My next contract with the Iron Monarch occurred in January 1974, when on vacation in Miramar River, I received a call that the ship had a problem at Port Kembla and couldn't sail. I cannot remember the actual problem with the temperature control system. It was difficult as I had never touched the Speedtronic temperature control system, and it was difficult as I had never touched it before and didn't have a calibrator or any other instrument. From memory, I think some meters were borrowed from the steelworks, and after working all night, I fixed the problem. This is when I started my Speedtronic hands-on training. The first thing I did when I returned to work was order a calibrator. There was various outstanding work that required completion, so the gas turbine department agreed to have me join the ship to investigate and resolve any problems that may arise. I joined the ship on the January 14th, 1974 at Port Kembla. Some of these trips were caused by wax fuel changeover problems. The main area of concern were trips which resulted from several areas over time. On the trip to Brisbane dry dock, the ship suffered two trips. The next was in Port Kembla, December 1973, and two more in January 74, see below. Two more reported in February 1974 at Port Kembla. One incident in Port Phillip Bay, when the turbine tripped and BHP head office had been notified that the turbine had tripped when restarted and finally berthed, half the office were there in panic demanding answers. The CE was puzzled when questioned on how the turbine was tripped, only to reply that he said tripped. Flame detection problems were difficult, as I had no confidence in the McGaw Edison flame detectors in use in the early machines. I found port side detector had bent slightly tube that restricted the site area. Turbine tripped in Yarra River on the went up the Yarra River on the July 28th, 1974, due to detectors flickering. This problem was finally fixed with the installation of a Honeywell system, which was far superior. B. The sectional reason. Low lube oil trips. These started in the south channel of Port Phillip Bay on the evening of April the 4th, 1974. Faulty oil tube pressure switch contacts were causing false low oil pressure signal to trip the turbine. The initial system operated the low lube tube oil trip by sensing the pressure with the pressure switch. Any fault with this switch causing the rapid loss of switch contact would trip the machine. Can I say, in my robotics, three or four sensors, the more the merrier, because you load up the sensors and then you get the system up and running and then you port the sensors away from things. It's interesting to see how this is done. This problem again occurred on the 4th of November 74 off Jervis Bay and failed to restart three times. Failed again 45 minutes later, so the switch jumped out to complete the voyage in Port Kembla, where I rewired the Speedtronic to have both the trip and the alarm switches showing a fault before the unit tripped. On startup on November 6th, there was a problem with the start permissive, so sailing was delayed by 2 hours. I sailed out with Bob Moffat to ensure all was well. There was a problem with the propeller pitch not going past 17%, which was found to be a bent rod. At the same time, the turbine tripped. Flinders Island was a quarter of a mile away, and closing the port anchor was dropped. Further adjustments were made to the lube oil circuits. We had to leave the ship before dark as launch service ceased. The bent pitch servo rod was repaired and the ship finally sailed at 9:30 at a delay of 6 hours. Gordon Lockhart in Melbourne on November 8th completed more work on the problem. Over temperature trips, this problem was caused by the 28-volt ground fault, which was picked up by a low impedance to ground exhaust thermocouple, which caused the rapid temperature control to reduce the fuel wind machine and wind the machine down. This problem was finally fixed by changing the exhaust thermocouples to a double shielded design that were completely isolated. Well, there you go. Isn't that amazing? I wish you knew. Yeah. Something very similar to that happened in Exmoor Lasers. Okay, one incident in Melbourne will always remain in my memory. We had left the loading berth to travel to Princess Pier to bunker. The GA USA salesman, John Ferrara, travelled down with us and he came to the engine room to have a look. We had been going for some time and to my surprise asked when they were going to start the turbine. We had berthed to bunker. After a while, I went up on deck looking around when suddenly there was hot oil flowing out some breather pipes running all over the deck. Some of the crew were sliding around like walking on ice. It appears that Wayne Owen and Pat Daly increased the flow rate before finally shutting the valves. Pat had been taking soundings when it all erupted. To make matters worse, the crew rushed to the only wharf phone to inform the authorities, the press, and the press preventing Captain Peter Blanca from reporting the spill as required by law. The caller was faking that he was talking to his girlfriend. Oh dear. Next, the press and the port authorities turned up with a van containing Frockman and containers to collect samples. The containers proved unsuccessful as the waxy oil had solidified, and it was hilarious to see the Frockman trying to carry a block of wax which kept melting through her fingers, and heard muttering, "What the fuck is this shit?" I still see Peter McCark trying to give a statement to the port official and being very careful about on every word. Oh my God, this is a complete nightmare. I didn't realise this shit was going to be so entertaining. This was a serious matter, as BHP MD had only a day to go before giving assurance at the government and media conference that BHP would never cause oil spills from its proposed seabed pipeline across Port Phillip Bay. Ken Farrell was immediately contacted the assistant MD, who demanded, not requested, a concise written report on the events by midnight so MD could face the press the next morning. The report highlighted the graphs showing the non-requested increase in flow rates from the refinery. The report also highlighted the fact that these new ships were using waste oil products that were environmentally friendly, and when it came into contact with the ocean, it solidified so it can be cleaned up with a net and a slow loader. This last point capitalised on the virtues of their forward-thinking strategies, because the storm subsided quickly as it started. It was later revealed that supplying refinery with a competitor who was strongly opposed to proposed seabed pipeline, and Ken said that if he had known the fact, that he would have been extremely careful. In fact, the fact that when the tanks were nearly full and the refinery were being told strongly on the phone to stop pumping, there was no response and the flow increased before the valves were shut. It all made for an exciting afternoon, however. More excitement was to come. On the evening of January the 23rd, the 1st, 1974, when berthing in Port Kembla was the most dramatic, the ship under command of Captain Bill Lloyd and its normal berthing with two tugs. With the chief engineer, Ken Farrell, I was standing in front of the speed trolleys when the turbine tripped off and started to wind down. There wasn't any alarm indication, and it was my turn to stand there like a stunned mullet. This caused major problems on the bridge as the ship lost steerage and pitch went to zero, which rendered the rudder ineffective when the ship turned to port heading towards the berth ship, main wharf, and Ridge Hopper barge, which was dredging the inner harbour. The ridge operator sitting in his hut must have wondered what was going to happen with the ship approaching without power. The anchors were dropped and the port anchor landed on the barge. The Western Dredging Company was not impressed. The turbine didn't start and would just drop out without any alarm or fault indication. As indeed three tugs berthed a dead ship, we sat there all night until a third tug came on duty this morning. After ship berth, the turbine started with no problem, which added to why it tripped, in the first place. The crew by this stage were jumpy and looked like they were going to strike. The PHP industrial officer, Malcolm Purcell, went into action to defuse the situation. He pulled me aside and said he had arranged for a meeting on the top deck with the crew, and I was to reassure them that the situation wasn't a major problem. I had kept away from the union since I attended the meeting at the AEU when I completed my apprenticeship with the intention of joining. All the bother, stuff and manipulation of proceedings cured me of unions for life, so I wasn't looking forward to the meeting. Malcolm kicked me off listening to the complaints about safety and quickly guarantor that apparent problems were not major. The leader demanded that there should be any future problems at all I could think of was that if you purchased a new car, the dealer wouldn't promise that the car would never have a problem. It seemed to work, and the meeting closed without any further action. The problem must have been caused by the alarm bells at gas turbine number one department. Was told later that they thought there was a design problem with the VMPA master protection card. I've got to finish off. I signed off at Port Kembla on February the 5th, 1974. Ralph Brown of GE Gas Turbine Department Design signed on the 13th of the 2nd, 1974 in Melbourne and signed off on the 16th of the 2nd, 1974 at Melbourne. I assumed he didn't know what had occurred, so he called for assistance. Well, I'm going to have to page, that's page 69, and we'll stop there. And what a fantastic thing.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.